Relationships rule. That's my motto. I'm Janice Porter, and I love to share the power of relationship marketing to help grow and impact business. I've grown my business by building and nurturing relationships, and I'd like to help you do the same. Welcome to the Relationships Rule podcast, where connection means everything. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Relationships Rule. This week, I am joined by Dr. Lisa Riegel, the author of NeuroWell and Aspirations to Operations, and an expert in the neuroscience of engagement. We often think of trust and connection as soft skills, something we either have or we don't. But what if trust is actually rooted in how our brain works? Lisa brings a fresh perspective on how understanding the brain can transform the way we build relationships in business and why good intentions alone aren't enough to create lasting connection. So welcome to the show, Lisa. I hope I got all that right.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure. So let's dig right in and start with you talk about trust as something that's rooted in the brain. What does that actually mean in simple terms?
So I think trust has to start with a sense of belonging. You know, if you think about if you walk into a meeting and you look around and you're like, oh, these are not my people.
Oh,
and you
yes.
kind of disengage, you know,
yes.
We've all had that experience.
Yes.
Or you walk in and you're like, oh, I might meet my new best friend here. And you open up and you engage. So I think when you're building trust in an organization, or if you're a leader that's trying to build trust with your staff, it starts with a sense of belonging and building that culture. And there's some, you know, the brain research behind that is that when we don't feel like these are our people, our brain senses danger. And our brain is programmed. What's really interesting and sad for us is that our brain is programmed from many, 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 many generations ago to keep us safe, right? And the dangers were different then than they are now. But the mechanism and the biology is the same. And so when we do not feel a sense of belonging, or, you know, there's five components to trust. So there's benevolence, which means you believe the other person has good intentions, reliability, open honestness, and competency. And so those five criteria, if those are present, then I trust you. And having that sense of belonging is really important for that openness and honesty piece. So it really does start in the brain, because the real key is we want to keep people's brains calm. We want them to know they're safe. And whether that's intellectual safety or psychological safety or physical safety, because if our brain perceives that we're not safe, it's gonna kick into stress, to the stress regulation system. And then what happens is that the part of our brain that makes us goes kind of numb, and we end up with the limbic system sort of taking over. And we actually, one thing too that's interesting is that 80% of the neural traffic in our brain is unconscious, and it happens below our nose. And so while we think we have a lot of control, I always tell people the limbic system and hormones make up a whole lot of how we behave, how we think, how we perceive. And if we understand that, then the real key to having self-control and being able to manage your emotions and your reactions is to equip your president of your brain with as much knowledge about what is swirling around down there. And then to be able to actually tell that part of your brain, hey, I don't want you to think that way. Like, this is how I want you to process. And we have the power to do that, which is really exciting. We can tell our brain what we want it to do.
Just like we tell ChatGPT how to do something, because I'm sorry, because I was on a call earlier. It was all about AI, and I'm still thinking about it. So a couple of things came to mind when you said that I've been standing, or I've walked into a room and felt it was the right place or not. And I've also stood on a stage and thought, oh my God, are these my people? How do I warm them up? Now, is any of that instinct? Is it instinct, or is it, because I'm not sure if instinct's the same as your brain telling you something.
So I think some of it is skill, but what actually happens with our perceptions, and I think the skill comes in of, are we accurately reading the room, right?
Okay.
So if we think of perceptions, like our brain has, so in that limbic system of the brain, so I talk about different departments in the brain. You've got like the president of your brain. That's where you live, your personality, everything. And then in that limbic system where there's 80% of your traffic going, you've got different departments. So you have one that's in your thalamus, and he's kind of your data manager. So I call him Harold. So Harold is my data manager. Then
It's
I
a
have
great name for a data manager. Sorry, but it
Isn't it?
works.
Yeah, yeah. He's my little nerd in there. Then I have, sorry to any Harolds listening. And then I have Bob, and Bob is my security guy. And so Harold and Bob are down there, and the way a perception is formed is that Harold's job is to talk to my vagus nerve, which is the largest nerve in my body, runs down my neck, around my heart and stomach. It's kind of my systems manager. It is always monitoring internally, are we okay? Is, your stomach emptying? Is your heart beating? Is everything working? And then it also looks at, it's called proprioception, which is where is my body in space? Because to stay safe, if I'm standing on the edge of a cliff, I need some kind of chemical juice to make sure I'm paying attention and alert so I don't fall off the mountain, right? So Harold's always talking to this nerve of how things are. We live in a world today where we don't move. We sit way too much. And so our proprioceptive input is getting worse. And in kids, it's really bad because they don't play. And the way you develop it is by rolling down hills and hanging upside down and, through movement. So what we find is that in today's world, Harold is always getting messages from the vagus nerve going, well, I don't really know where the feet are, or I don't know what's going on. So it ratchets up a little bit of stress. The second job is Harold looks into the environment and says, okay, I hear this, I see this, I smell this. He's only looking at sensory stimulus. He goes into the sensory memory folder. And we think of memories like a library where you can pull the file folder out of when you went to some amusement park or something. That's not how it works. They're actually fragmented and stored in multiple different parts of the brain. So when we want to make a meaningful memory, the CEO of our brain has to ask for the memory and call up all these different fragments, put them together. Harold doesn't have access to that. So Harold will just say, like, say that you wear glasses that remind me of my, teacher from fifth grade, and I loved my teacher from fifth grade. I'm going to feel a sense of belonging with you because Harold is going to make an association between what he's seen now and how he felt in a similar situation. Because if everything we ever experienced was brand new, our brain would explode. So we look for those associations. So what happens then is if you think of reality like a banana, and then you think of all these filters and associations as different, like spaghetti strainers or filters that Harold pulls up. Harold pulls them all up, shoves the banana through, and then has this lump that doesn't look anything like reality anymore. And he sends that information to Bob to say, hey, are we in danger? How the last time we were in a situation with similar associations, this is how our body felt. This is what we needed to react to stay safe. And then Bob has to decide, do I hit the panic button? And if I do, then he sends a message up to us, to the conscious part, and says, hey, fire drill, building's on fire, you're in danger, go get some lunch somewhere, go get a cup of coffee, we'll call you when things are safe. And then Bob and Harold take over. And that's kind of why, like, if you have a day where you're super angry and then you calm down, you're like, why did I even say that? Like, I don't even believe that. Why did I say it? Because you didn't. Bob and Harold were doing what they had to do to keep you safe. If Bob decides, well, maybe you're in a room and you're like, okay, some people are not my people, and some people kind of look like they could be. He might just tap that panic button. And then a message goes up to the president of your brain that says, hey, we need you to weigh in. We have conflicting associations here. So you're going to have to be alert. So we're going to give you a little bit of juice to make you more alert. And that's where you get you stress, EU, like good stress. Is it just kind of ramped up? So that perception piece, it's not really intuition. It's a whole lot of thinking going on below our nose. And it's totally based on the associations that our brain is making between what's happening now and our entire past, which is also interesting because a lot of times the way we feel right now may have nothing to do with the reality of the moment. And, for example, I always use the example, when I was growing up, my parents were divorced. My dad was always late. And so I spent a huge chunk of my childhood sitting on the front stoop waiting for him to pick me up. My little 8-year-old brain associated time with love and worth, right? So I would be sad, my body would be stressed. So I had those negative body reactions to his lateness. All the way into my 20s and 30s, If my husband was late or I was running late, I would have anxiety and anger and all these things, even though I could rationalize that it's nobody's fault, right? So I had to learn, once I understood that association, then me, the president of my brain, said, "Hey, Harold, don't make that association. This is not that. You get to choose how you respond here. So don't tell Bob to hit the panic button." So I started to have more self-control. And in the long run, as a leader or as just a human being, when we have self-awareness, self-regulation, and self-control, we have a much happier, healthier, successful life.
Okay, there's so much stuff there. I mean, I think you just answered the first four questions or something that I had here because you, it made me think so many things. One, well, here I thought I was really intuitive, number one. And number two, love your analogies and how I'm sure you hook your audiences and your and make it fun for your audiences to learn this stuff because you're a academic doctor, right? You can make it very, very academic, but you can't in an office or an audience filled with the leaders of the teams of a company. So I can see where you've had to adjust that too, probably. But
Yeah,
then
and I don't
also,
think,
you were a teacher, right?
yes, I was a teacher.
So that's the background, though, that helps in that regard for sure.
I taught at-risk kids, so you've got to find the analogy to teach at-risk kids. But I do think that we don't need to be neuroscientists. We just need a basic understanding of how our brain works. And what's nice is that when we understand that, we can release some of the guilt and shame that comes with feeling off. And like even, as a teacher to a student or as a parent to a kid or even a spouse or friend, like I might say to you, Janice, what is your Harold telling you? Because you're having a completely different reaction than I am, versus what's wrong with you? Or why are you acting like this, right? It reduces that like conflict and shame and instead makes me an ally to you. Let me tell you what my Harold's telling me about the situation. And then helping people to de-escalate when they're in that moment.
And bond a little bit at the same time and begin that trust piece, right?
That benevolence. I'm not trying to push you down, I'm trying to support you.
But I have to say, the example that you used about your waiting for your dad, that I had that so strongly when I was married the first time. I was young. I'd just gotten out of school, university, and I was teaching, and my husband was still at university, and he would never make it home for Friday night dinner. He always stopped at the pub on the way home, and then I got this anxiety every time. And then that was my starter marriage, and then my long-term marriage. At the beginning, I still had that anxiety, although this person was a completely different person and would never have done the same thing. I still, if he was that much late or, and didn't call me, my anxiety just went crazy. So I totally, I learned to adapt and trust and all of that. But that's where it came from. So once you know where it comes from, that helps, right?
It
Totally.
totally helps. Because then if you walk into a room and you start to feel yourself uncomfortable, you have that moment to stop and say, what am I associate? What is bothering me in this environment? And can I tell my brain that this is not that? Or is this truly a warning sign that I need to be careful?
Yeah, that's so true. Okay. So I don't know if we've already answered this, but I'm going to start with this question five because I'm skipping the other ones. You said that, well, you explained what's happening neurologically when we feel safe and also when trust starts to break down. So, you've said, though, that good intentions aren't enough. Why is there often a gap between intention and real connection?
Yeah, I think it's a skills gap, and I think part of it is when you have two people who have no self-awareness, right? So say you and I, we both come with our own sensory associations or, baggage from the past, whatever. And so you're sending out information out of your mouth or nonverbal information that my Harold is interpreting and associating. And so you are sending out information that maybe I'm in, the banana is smashed and I'm interpreting it as you're mad at me or I'm not good enough or whatever. And what's interesting too is an activity that I do with people where we list out like what are the things that stress you out? Like what are things that just mildly upset you versus things that are like a five alarm fire? Is it like big open spaces or big crowds or too much noise or being late or having somebody give you feedback or wanting to do something and being told no? Or, what are the things that just really make you insanely angry? And you can usually trace them back to parts of your past that have, whether it's your identity and your family or things like that. So when we think about trust, like to me, trust at the end of the day, if you're my friend, we're ride or die, right? I always say ride or die friends, right? So I'm here because when you do better, I do better. Like I'm here to support and love you, not to be in competition. And so having, a self-awareness of who you are and what those things are that make you feel safe, I'm going to want to give those to you. And that builds a trust with you that you're going to feel safe around me. But if I'm not self-aware and I'm running through my own dysregulated brain because whatever you said set me off from something from, 20 years ago, then I'm not re then I'm reacting. Harold and Bob are fighting with each other. And I see a lot of people, I even see a lot of couples where you've got people who are completely dysregulated, anxiety, stress has overtaken their life. The president of their brain is like swimming in coffee at this point, not in the office, not doing any leadership. And so their whole relationship is really built on the Harolds and the Bobs talking to each other. And we're really missing out on the beauty of the human being because up here is what makes us human. Harold and Bob are just there to keep us alive.
Okay, so when you go into an organization and you work with them, what have they called you for, or who's your ideal client in that regard? Like, let's start there.
So I do a lot of work in schools because I do have a big network in
Sure,
education.
makes
So
sense.
for school clients, they'll call me in and generally they want to improve their culture, their climate. Oftentimes I get called in because they have a bunch of behavior problems with kids. And so they're having me come in to like deal with their complicated orders. And then we start to talk about all of this brain stuff.
With the staff, with the entire staff.
So I will work. I'll come in. Sometimes we do a book study or I do a keynote. I take five or six clients a year where they really want to make transformative culture shifts to move, to a safer culture for people. And I'll work deeply with them. It usually takes about 2 years of like really planting the seeds, watering the seeds, and then, getting them to
And
grow.
this is schools.
That's schools, yeah. And then in the business world, and then I also work in schools. So NeuroWell is my book that's really about those culture pieces for schools. Aspirations for Oper to Operations is a leadership book, and it's the idea that leaders conceptualize change, but they don't know how to operationalize it. And so what we end up with is initiative fatigue, or we end up with people burning out. I just read an article, two-thirds of the American workforce is burned out at this point and disengaged, which is pretty scary and not good for the bottom dollar of profits and everything else. So I go in and do leadership work in organizations, regardless of the industry, where I'll say, okay, what are the things that you want to see change? What's your theory of change for improvement? And then we work through what I call the 8C commitment framework, which is all grounded in brain science to say, how do we set up the conditions? There's three kind of planning C's. So it's clarity, coherence, and cadence. There's two engagement C's, which is coaching and collaboration. And then there's two sustainability C's, which are celebration and communication. And they're all kind of wrapped around a culture, that C. So this 8C framework, we kind of go through and do strategy and operationalize each one, each different C. There's exercises to do to help the leader become more self-aware so that they can then be a safe leader for the people. And then there's also just techniques and things they can do to understand, why people resist change. So, like, for example, leaders sometimes will be like, this is what's good for the company. We're going to be putting this new practice in or this new software or whatever. And their staff is pushing back. And I'm like, have you considered that when you ask somebody, you bring something else in, somebody is an expert of the process you're replacing. And that person may have worked there for 20 years. And now all of a sudden, you're pulling that out from under them
They're
and
threatened. Yeah.
it's an identity threat. So there's different reasons that people resist change. So understanding your staff and what, kind of what makes them motivated can help you lead change with less stress involved.
Yeah, I always remember back in the day when I was training in corporate environments, and I'd go to a company and they'd have the people there that they wanted there, that team or whatever it was, and you'd see them sitting there like this
Yep, arms
before,
crossed,
arms
looking down
crossed,
their
before you got there,
noses.
and you thought you're doomed before you start. So I'm curious though, what do you find? Because I've taught school as well, and I have been in corporate environments. Which do you find the most resistant when you come in? Or
You know, it's interesting. I think that it 100% depends on the leader
yeah, that makes
opposed
sense.
to the staff. You know, and people like to think, oh, teachers
How
hate
they
change.
present it, right? How they present it to them. Yeah.
And I always say too, doesn't matter what industry you're in, your company is like a crew boat with 10 people on it. You've got about two people that are rowing in the right direction as hard as they can. You've got five people that are staring at the scenery. They periodically stick their oars in and start rowing. Sometimes they're helping. Sometimes they're actually adding drag because they're rowing in the wrong direction, right?
Yeah.
And then you have two to three people, depending on your culture, that are literally drilling holes in your boat trying to sink it. And so, as a leader, if you think about, one of the things I talk about is cadence of change. And everybody's not going to change the same way. So I
Right.
do aptitude attitude matrix, and we talk about what are the reasons for people to be in those quadrants and how we coach them and how we support them and how we set up collaboration or informal leadership is determined on our understanding of why they are in those different boxes. And so, that kind of stuff can help get those five people moving
Yeah.
in the right direction. And then now when you got 7 to 3 or 8 to 2, you've got a culture of that's going to turn around
Right.
and look at the boat sinkers and be like, dudes, get on the boat or go home.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. So, could you share a simple example of how someone could shift their approach and immediately improve their connection with other people, their relationships?
So I think asking the question why. So, again, if I understand what's going on in your brain, that this is a Bob Harold situation going on, and you're coming to me and you're frustrated, I think listening for the fear, right? Listening for what is the fear beneath the complaint. So if I come in and I'm like, Janice is always needling me, and she's telling me I'm not, and she's not, nothing I ever do is going to make her happy, and she's blah, blah, blah. Asking some questions to get to the underlying fear. Is the underlying fear that I want to be perfect and I want you to recognize that I'm good at my job, and so criticism is seen to me as a threat? Or maybe you, who you're giving me the criticism, maybe you love feedback and you've been in a situation where feedback has been empowering and I've been in one where it's been belittling. So
Yes.
understanding that fear behind it, because then all of a sudden it's oftentimes not what you say, it's how you say it.
Oh, I hear that a lot from my husband. Yeah, no, it's true though. I think sometimes you don't hear yourself. Quite often you don't hear yourself. So it's not what you're saying, it's how you're saying it. Yeah, I like that. My whole thing is about, building relationships with people, and you can't like everybody, and everybody can't like you. So does that ever come up in your leadership training where you see that or sense it from the conversations that are going on? Because I'm not sure whether you are you in the trenches with the people, you're doing exercises with them and things like that, or are you just keynote speaking? Probably do both, but
Yeah, I do both.
okay. Yeah, so I'm talking about when you're doing the workshop type of stuff. So how do you deal with that? How do you recommend, suggest, or teach people that you got to get along with these people because you're going to be with them all day long? So how do you do it so that you're not killing
I
each
think
other.
some of it is figuring out why you don't like them, and what is, what is
So it's
your fear?
back to the why again. Yeah.
It
And
is
the,
that, yeah. And so it's like looking, so like I have some people, so I golf on a league, and
Yep.
we've got probably 45 women. You're not going to have 45 women that all sing Kumbaya together, right?
Right.
So there's some of the women I really enjoy and some that I really don't.
Yeah.
And in order for me not to end up feeling like that these are not my people and then have my body dysregulate where I
Yes.
don't enjoy the process of golfing anymore, I spend some time to say, okay, what is the need that they're fulfilling in this behavior? And why is that upsetting me so much? And what it does is it takes every single thing they do as annoying, and it situates down to, I might still have a conflict with them at some point,
Yeah.
but I'm not bothered by some of the things that would normally bother me because I'm looking at them through the lens of what need are they? All behavior serves a need.
Yes.
What is the need they have? Do they have a need for attention? Do they have a need for power? Do they have a need to be seen as the most intelligent person in the room? And that's something I've learned as I've gotten older. I'm a smart lady. I'm oftentimes a smart person in the room,
Yeah.
but I don't have to be the smartest person in the room. I don't
Yeah.
always have to show I'm right. Even when I'm in a setting and somebody's going off about something, and I'm like, oh Lord, that is completely not at all how I would interpret what is happening.
Right.
Able to sit back and say, do I have a need to be the right one, or can I just let that person have it? Is this the hill I want to die on, kind of thing? And
Yeah, that's
I think
good.
that it's important when you're in a work setting as well
Yeah.
to understand, because sometimes too, it might be, I can't stand her because she's constantly complaining and moaning or this person's lazy and always the work always falls back on me. If you start to get beyond the what is irritating to you to the why are they doing that behavior, and can I change the way I behave that will then change their behavior?
Yeah, and make me the better person in my mind and keep me from saying something I shouldn't say as well, right?
And
Yeah.
sometimes too, those people are operating because they have a fear. They don't know that they're going to be good enough, or they're, nervous that they won't be included, or whatever their baggage is that they're coming to work with. If you extend that olive branch and you give them what they need, all of a sudden they might not be a person you don't like. You might open they, you might be a person where they're saying, these are not my people, and they're always agitated. If you can calm them down, you might actually meet the real person.
Yeah, there's so much. It's so complex. It really is. And you have to make these decisions in an instant, basically, right? Okay, so let's just divert a little bit for now so my audience can find out more a little more about. I know you're a golfer. I know you live in Ohio. How do you, because you're an academic, you probably read a lot, I'm assuming, which one shouldn't do, but how do you take in your information these days? Do you still like to read a hard cover book? Do you watch videos on YouTube? Do you listen to audiobooks? What's your go-to?
I'm on the road a lot, so I listen to audiobooks a lot because if I'm in an airport or something, I can read a book,
Yeah.
but I'm in
Not in
my
the
car
car,
so much.
obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
Okay.
I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I listen to some of the different podcasts or things about psychology, about business, about people, trust. There's The Hidden Brain is one that I just love, and
Oh,
so I
okay.
listen to that one. And I do, I am on LinkedIn, so I'll see things on LinkedIn that come by. I just joined Substack, so I'm trying to figure out how that works. But
Yeah.
I get a lot of stuff from them, and so
Yes,
it's
you do.
overload. But trying to, consume what I can, I try to actually read slowly, because I can read super fast, but like I try to take my time to really like stop and think. So sometimes even when I'm listening to a book or a podcast, something will be interesting and I'll turn it off, and then I'll talk into my phone like
Oh,
what I heard,
yeah.
and oh, that reminds me of this, or oh, I could use that when I'm talking to somebody here. So I'm always trying to take what I read or hear and apply it in a way that would be positive for the people I'm working with.
So, do you ever read novels?
I do. In fact, I'm reading a crime novel right now that's called what is it called? The Vanishing Man.
Oh,
And
okay.
so,
Okay,
yeah.
because I was going to say, like, I know I'm like that too. It's the business stuff that it's coming at you so quickly that you kind of have to, when you're in your car, catch up on that kind of thing, right?
Yep.
But, and I did it for so long that I stopped reading like real books. And I finally just read a novel when I was away and it was delightful. And
Yeah.
I might have to do that again,
Yeah,
right?
yeah. I
Yeah.
kind of I feel like reading a novel is like my recess from life, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the thing too is, you know, when you understand the brain stuff and you start to really try to be a student of this for your own
Yeah.
self-awareness. And I'm in my first degree was in English literature. So
Ah,
I love
oh,
literature.
fantastic. Okay.
And I think that it's unfortunate that we don't teach it in a way that people like the lessons you learn from the people. So like when I'm reading literature, I'm thinking through like what would have been her backstory that would make her respond that way, or what, you know, like you
Oh,
just get a much
awesome.
richer kind of the interpersonal stuff that's going on in the story. So I do love those stories. My favorite book ever is Wuthering Heights. When I was
Oh,
in
isn't
college,
that funny?
I wrote a paper on why people love Heathcliff, even though.
Did you see the new movie? Because I hear it's very different.
Yeah, I haven't. I've heard it's like 50 Shades of Gray,
Oh, okay.
and
Yeah.
they turned it into a real sexualized thing, which
Yeah.
in the book it is not. It's more
Yeah.
of a pure
No.
type love. So I
And
kind of want to see it.
that's one I haven't actually read. I was more, I guess, into Jane Austen and then,
Yeah.
yeah. But anyway, it's fascinating. I'm going to ask you this question that I like to ask most people on my just whether I think of it or not, but I think you would have your own take on it, and that is about curiosity. My favorite word is curiosity. I think that my podcast runs through being a curious person, and I want to know your take on it's a two-part question. First one is curiosity, in your opinion, innate or learned? And second part is, what are you most curious about today?
So, the first part, I think it is not innate. I think it is learned. I think there's some curiosity that is innate and on things that we just automatically are drawn to and interested in. But, you know, I talk about curiosity a lot because I feel like our ability to network, our ability to make relationships and to have trust, it requires that we're curious about other people. And unfortunately, in today's world, people are not getting practice. Like our kids are not having, when I was a kid, I had family dinner. You had to sit there, right? And they were boring and you had to listen to, so I had to learn to be curious and ask questions so that I wasn't bored. And, you know, when I was a kid, my dad would have parties. He had an office and his office staff would come over. I was expected to be delightful and represent the family and talk to people, right? So, you know, I'm talking to these adults and I have to be curious about them. And I feel like curiosity, my ability to find something interesting in what other people are saying and be able to kind of apply it and drive a conversation around is based on all these experiences that I had growing up and the skills that I built around that. And
Okay.
curiosity to me is the center of being successful, because if you're not curious about anybody else, you're just self-centered, right?
It's true.
And
I always say it's a quote from somebody, and I don't know who it was. It's better to be interested than interesting.
yes, yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
Yeah.
People like to, you know, they feel special. And then
Yeah.
again, from that like protective and building trust, it's like I'm really truly interested in who you are as a human.
Right.
So I think that that is a critically important skill, and it's one that we're not teaching in the moment. And then what was the second part of your question?
What are you most curious about these days?
I have to say, what I'm most curious about is what is AI going to do to humanity?
Yeah.
I worry about that because we are cognitively offloading the tasks that our brain does right now. Like, you know, even when phones came, we stopped memorizing phone numbers. So our
Some
working
people did. Some people
yeah,
did.
some people
Yes.
did. Yeah.
Yes. But
And
mostly they did. Yes.
yeah. And
Sure.
even maps and understanding
Yeah.
spatially where we are, like a lot of the things that we used to have to do and that would work the functions in our part of our
Well,
brain.
telling time. When I used to teach school,
Yep.
digital clock watches came in. And I had taught the little ones in the first part of my teaching career. And I always said that they were always going to learn how to tell read a clock, an analog clock, and how to tie their shoelaces. I don't care if they never have a pair of shoes with
Yeah.
shoelaces again. And
Yeah.
yeah, so it's
Yeah.
just,
So I worry about it. I worry
right.
about it with the systems as well. You know, I
Sure.
know like education, you know, when you think about school, what's the purpose of school? I mean, it used to be content transmission, but now we can get all the content we ever wanted in whatever format we want at any time we want. And it'll actually even synthesize and analyze and do all of
Yeah.
this stuff with content. So, like,
But
that,
now
if that's,
sorry, I think it really
yeah.
needs to be socializing now
Yes.
more because,
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, because content transmission isn't the challenge to be successful in tomorrow's world. And then we did career development and career pathways, but who knows what pathway we're gonna, I mean, nobody can tell you that. So I feel like we're at a really interesting time to redefine our purpose. And I believe our purpose is the human thinking. And it's like, how do we teach kids to think, teach them to be curious, teach them to socially interact and fill the gap that AI is going to not be able to fill.
That's very, very important. And another whole conversation
Yeah.
probably.
Yeah.
So one last question. If there's one mindset shift you'd like my listeners to walk away with when it comes to relationships, what would it be?
It's not about you. Like, what is happening in the moment between you and anyone you're in a relationship with has something to do with you and what's happening right now, but it has everything to do with how that person's brain is associating the current state with a whole history that you may or may not even know. And so it's not always about you. And then the second thing I would say too that's really important is that, you know, if we've got all these negative filters and associations in our brain, the solution to pollution is dilution. So positivity,
Say that
right?
again. Say that again.
The solution to pollution is dilution. So if we have lots of negative filters and associations in our brain, how do we counteract that? Positivity, appreciation, gratitude, all those kinds of things build positive associations. So now Harold says, well, some things are negative and some are positive. Hey, Bob, just tap it because we need this. We need your president of your brain to tell us what to do. So it helps to regulate you to be able to have that you know, dilution in your brain.
Yeah, love it. This has been delightful. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for your brilliance and your wisdom. Where can my audience find you and your books?
So they can go to lisaregal.com and there's links, right? My books are on Amazon. There's links from there to the books, or I'm on LinkedIn. So if they connect with me on LinkedIn, and I always tell people, you know, connect with me and send me a message. I just had somebody who listened to a podcast I did a couple weeks ago, and she reached out and scheduled something on Calendly, and we had a wonderful chat. So, you know,
Fantastic.
please don't hesitate to just reach out and say, hey, I liked what you had to say. Let's get to know each other.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you. And I encourage my audience to do that, to check out Lisa's books and her work. And you never know, right? Because it's very fascinating work, the brain. And on your LinkedIn, I love your banner. It says, "Real change starts in the brain." And
Yep.
that's what you're all about. It's very obvious, and I can tell that you're passionate about it. So that's amazing. Thank you for that. And again, to my audience, if you like what you heard, please let us know, leave a review, reach out to Lisa, reach out to me, and remember to stay connected and be remembered. Thanks for joining us. If today's show inspired you to make a new connection, why not start with me? Head over to LinkedIn and connect with me. Be sure to let me know you are a podcast listener because I select one listener each month who connects with me on LinkedIn for a complimentary profile audit. And you know, I love to meet new people, so I hope you take me up on it. Don't forget to stay connected and be remembered.